Кремль не намерен продлевать договор о разграничении полномочий.
Если
между
договор
Казани,
не продлить, то образуется правовой вакуум.
Требование Госсовета Татарстана заключить новый договор.
Благодаря договору Татарстан динамично развивается.
This week, Russia's official name officially became a fiction. This week, the Russian Federation ceased to be anything remotely resembling a federation. This week, a decades-old agreement granting Tatarstan limited autonomy, including control over its resources, budget, and a special status for the Tatar language, was allowed to expire. And the Kremlin is showing no signs of reviving it. One of Russia's most important regions and its largest ethnic minority just got downgraded. What does this mean for Tatarstan, and what does it mean for Moscow's relations with the regions? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back. And also with us in the studio is Rim Gilfanov, director of RFERL's Tatar Bashkir service. Welcome back to the podcast, Rim. Good to have you.
Very pleased to be here.
Very pleased to have you. So in the past, and since this is your wheelhorse, Rim, we'll get the ball rolling with you. In the past, the authorities in Kazan have fought tooth and nail for Tatarstan's special status. But this time they barely put up a fight. They just seem to not really push this as hard. Or maybe I'm missing something. What happened here? Is the current Tatar president Rustam Minnikhanov simply weaker than his predecessor Mintimir Shamiyev? Has the Tatar national movement lost its influence? What's going on? Why did this agreement expire without a fight?
The answer to the question is actually not simple, and I would say multifaceted, Brian. First of all, this is a logical result of so-called bargain policy exercised initially by Tatarstan's first president Shaimiev and then continued by current president Minnikhanov, who is even more businessman type of leader. It means the politician who cares mostly about the economical side of only. And Tatarstan leaders could capitalize all the potential Tatarstan had with its autonomy aspirations in early 90s. Strong national movement based on Tatar will to gain more independence from Moscow was a substantial part of that potential. But as Shaimiev got what he wanted, above all assets like Tatneft, major petrochemical plants and other parts of regional industry, several symbolic things like presidency, power to establish external trade and business relations, flag and relations with Moscow, formally based on bilateral treaty. So he decided the deal was done. There was no need to support it by the will of the people. And he started actually to strangle Tatar national movement because they sort of, you know, they interfere.
Shaimiev,
yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not only federals, but Shaimiev. The official Moscow also assisted to this process. So national movement was killed to the extent it almost complete disappearance. And so now capitalized assets are slowly gone, and there are only the treaty and the presidency, the name of the presidency.
So basically you're saying Shaimiev traded true autonomy for fake autonomy. They got the flag, they got the name of the president,
he got
page in the passport in Tatar, as I understand. They got Tatneft.
He got real autonomy, but for himself and his family. Mm-hmm. But if you look to Tatarstan as a form of statehood, it was actually more formal. Mm-hmm. And more formal as Putin implemented his policy of centralization.
Uh-huh. And now what happened? But they did renegotiate the treaty in 2007. The original treaty was signed in 94, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes, right.
The treaty was renewed in 2007 under Putin, still Shaimiev, but with Putin this time. Why didn't Minnikhanov just continue this trajectory? Why was Moscow not willing to go along with this deal? Because I saw, from the way I saw this, the elites all got a very good deal here. Right? Moscow got complete loyalty out of Tatarstan. Tatarstan's leadership got these symbolic things and control of Tatneft and other enterprises. And it seemed like it was a deal that suited everybody. Why not renew it again?
Well, the situation changed. I mean, this power vertical...
It's the real one, not my blog.
Yeah. it's completely different than in 2007, for example. The power of Putin is much more centralized, and he has much more power, and it's not balanced by other Czechs. So, in fact, Moscow has corrupted the Tatar elite with bombastic projects like Kazan's Millennium Celebration, Universiade Games with major reconstruction of the whole city.
Kazan will be a World Cup venue.
Yes, and several international events, including World Cup in 2018. Then positioning Kazan as Russia's third capital, formal thing, but it also attracted sort of tourism to Tatarstan, brought some money. So all of that satisfied local elites' basic ambitions, but in fact gave nothing in real. And at the same time, Moscow has strictly controlled Kazan's. Kazan couldn't become too self-confident about its independence, especially on international level.
But at the same time, and I remember the last time we had you on the podcast and we talked about this, I mean, the Tatar elites were building up the attributes of statehood in a lot of ways. You had these representative offices being opened abroad, foreign consulates being opened in Kazan. And we were speculating that if someday the Russian Federation were to break apart, the one place that looks like a viable state is Tatarstan.
And that's exactly why now Moscow decided not to continue with the treaty. Because all things you talked about, they are, of course, symbolic. They are more formal things. But at the same time, they are sort of prepared structures.
It's the case of the architecture of statehood. Yes, exactly. Yes, it's almost like an insurance policy.
So, and I think we will talk about it probably later too. But Moscow has actually stigma about the breakup of the Russian Federation now.
Yes.
It's a much bigger problem. It's like after the collapse of Soviet Union, and especially this political elite, which is in power now in Moscow,
they are just terrified
about this possible future.
Well, this is what I want to turn to Mark with this and get at this a little bit, because I think they actually just may have made that more, not less likely, because as the situation was, like I said, everybody was happy. Tatarstan was a loyal subject of the Federation as long as it got this symbolic status. Taking away the symbolic status, I fear, and I want to return to this with you later, Rim, could kind of reignite these separatist tendencies that I witnessed myself living in Kazan in the early 90s. But I want to go to Mark on this, because in a column for Republic Ru this week, Oleg Kashin wrote that the Kremlin's taking a pretty big risk with this move. He wrote that it's basically harder to have a privilege taken away from you than to not have that privilege granted in the first place. Do you see this as a risky move, Mark?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's be clear that when we talk about privileges being withdrawn, I mean, actually many of them had already disappeared since 2010. So it's not like suddenly a sort of dramatic change. Yes, much of this is symbolic, and of course politics is about symbolism. But it has to be mobilised. I don't think there's going to be sort of mobs on the streets of Kazan saying, "Where is my passport?" with it with its Tatar page. Particularly when precisely, I mean, as Rim's identified, so many of the privileges were privileges for the rich and powerful of Tatarstan rather than your average Tatar. Now, your average Tatar lived okay, but you might say it's not as if they're suddenly going to find a sort of massive sort of disproportionate miseration.
But let me push back that on just a little bit, because these things that are privileges for the elite are sold to the public as privileges for them, essentially. I mean, think about Crimea, right? And that's going to it's making a lot of money for the elite, right? The Kerch Bridge and so on and so forth. But it's sold to the public as this patriotic thing of Krim Nash. The whole thing with Tatarstan works the same way. Yeah, the elite really did well for itself. But the public, at least the Tatar public, got something it can grasp onto as well. And that's worth something. Yeah, and losing
that. You made that point about it's sold. It needs to have someone. I mean, absolutely. I think this is definitely something that could potentially be mobilized. But the point is, I don't think it's going to bubble up naturally. Mm. Actually, someone has to mobilize. And again, it's interesting, even if we look at the nationalism that broke the Soviet Union apart, that was mobilized. That was mobilized by both, you know, local ethnic groups and national groups, which had sort of their own movement. But often it was actually elites that, precisely because they saw which way was going, decided to reinvent themselves as national. So in part, actually, the question is, what happens to the Tatar elites? And I think this is one of the interesting things, because, you know, this very much, as it were, puts the mini into Minikhanov. I mean, it very much kind of takes away. This can only be interpreted as a failure for him. And even though it's a kind of consolation prize to say, okay, you know, there won't be another president of Tatarstan, but you can hold on to the title
until
for a while.
2020. For
exactly.
Years.
I mean that is one of those kind of we'll do you a favor that actually makes you look all the more pathetic. As a result. So in some ways, one of the things that interests me, and I'd be very interested to hear what Rim has to say about that, is precisely about actually whether this doesn't so much weaken Tatarstan, but whether it weakens Minikhanov, and if so, who else is there? Who is, as it were, you know, alternatively might be thinking, this is my chance for power, and how I do that is by mobilizing
That's a good question, because I've been seeing stuff in the media about Tatar officials and politicians and members of parliament speaking up about this. And you said the Tatar national movement was crushed, but it still exists, no?
Yeah, it still exists, but it's to the term of, you know, marginalization of the movement. Mm. So those people are considered as silly people now, just simply.
Do you think they'll start being considered less silly now that something has been taken away from them?
It depends. If the part of the elite, Tatar elite, which was participating in the leadership, will move at least partly to some opposition. Mm-hmm. And they can relight something, this national movement somehow. But I think the problem is not only in the national movement here. It's actually the struggle of identification. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, the majority of the population started identifying itself with the Tatarstan, mm-hmm. with our region, which has some potential, and we can do something with it. But you mentioned Crimea, you mentioned Ukrainian events. So I think this also helped to empower Putin's position, because the population in Tatarstan also became a part of this pro-Russian, pro-chauvinistic, pro-Crimean, we are the great nation philosophy or concept. So that's why they are actually indifferent. I mean, because they are still in the same state, the same country, and they associate themselves mostly with the Russian ideology now instead of
This is true even among Tatars.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Because I see that Krimnash high starting to fade. More than starting. I see the fading of it accelerating. And we're seeing this in, it's showing up in opinion polls. It's showing up on the streets. With the protests we've been seeing, we're seeing the kind of the Crimea drug wearing off. And in that environment, one has to wonder if making a move like this with Tatarstan, one of Russia's richest and most important regions and its largest ethnic minority, isn't that dangerous in this situation? I can't get around. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree here.
They're actually playing va-bank, as the Russians say, because, I mean, of course, there are some possible developments. It might get backlash,
right?
Or it might peacefully just continue in this way. So the current presidential administration in Moscow, especially Sergei Kirienko, because particularly this is connected to him. I mean, rumors in Moscow are that it was Kirienko's idea not to extend the treaty, because he had some, I don't know, disputes.
Shamiev, was prime minister in the 90s. Yes, this Kashin got into this.
Especially he was a presidential envoy in Volga region, so they had some problems with Shamiev at that time. So it's presented like partly also his personal revenge.
Now, back to Mark's question, actually, though, I found this interesting. Who is there in Tatarstan that could pick up the Tatar flag, so to speak, if Minikhanov's not going to carry it, if the current official elite is not going to carry it. Are there people that can pick up this mantle?
The federal government actually had very clever and wise policy about abolishing all the possible ethnic, this conscious, especially was, I mean, it focused on potential leaders too.
Yeah.
So the excellent case would be if Shaimiev could lead this, but he cannot because he's tied to this with his sons, to this property he privatized. He got some assets, so he cannot. He's already tied, you know, by federal
he's
government.
He's captured, as they say, through corruption, essentially.
Yeah, there were some ideas. For example, there is a so-called World Congress of Tatars, which we'll have, by the way, next week. It's
in Kazan.
In Kazan, yeah. The session, it's in 5 years, once in 5 years. So it will have a session. So we expect some harsh resolution, for example, demanding treaty. But it's pro-government, it's official, and then mostly very predictable leaders are sitting there.
So there's nobody out there that you see that could...
So far not.
Become the Tatar Navalny, if you will, within Tatarstan.
But the person can appear, I mean, in a matter of months. It's
right.
No problem. But so far, they're really somehow broke up, and this national movement not in good condition.
Now, we were talking off mic yesterday, Rim, when you pointed out to me a piece in Sputniki Pogrom, the nationalist publication, about how to solve the so-called Tatar problem. And you were pretty disturbed by this piece, and it's disturbing. What flesh this out for us. What did you see in this piece? There's a lot to bother people in there, but I want to hear it from you.
Yeah, federal government, actually, Putin as a president never said anything against Tatar, for example. In words, they are like completely supporting the Russia's diversity, ethnic diversity. They say it's our asset, you know, we can nourish it somehow. But in fact, they are doing everything. The policy inside the country is directed in having, in some time in the future, homogeneous, most likely one language, one religion, one mindset, population. So, and actually the Moscow government in Moscow see the diversity of Russia as a big danger for the Russian statehood. So that's why I said, I mean, they have a stigma about the possible dissolution of Russian Federation too. So they are doing everything just to avoid it, and Russification comes out.
This is essentially what the Sputnik and Pogrom article.
Yes.
If you strip away all the words and charts and everything they have, we're talking about the full Russification of Tatarstan.
Yes, exactly. They are, putting the ways how to achieve this. For example, inter-ethnic marriages, very productive in this. So... Sputnik and Pogrom actually announced the policy Kremlin has been engaged for years now as Putin came to power.
Mm-hmm. Mark, anything to add there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, if we try and put this into a sort of a big picture, I mean, first of all, and I know we'll be talking in the second half about sort of broader regional policy, but in a way, yes, there's all this sort of the potential personal animus from the presidential administration or whatever, but also on a broader level. Originally, you had 46 different treaties and so forth.
It had shrunk
and eventually sort of...
Tatarstan stood
alone. Chechnya, Kadyrov kind of notionally presented it, which is ironic given the extent to which actually Chechnya is virtually an independent country, except when it comes to paying its bills. So in that respect, Tatarstan was the only one that was left. And so it was a clear exception, particularly at a time when regions are beginning to get a little bit more bolshy, a little bit more agitated yep. about the question of how much they give to the center and how much they take. And Tatarstan, precisely as a relatively prosperous region.
A donor region.
Precisely. I mean, so you have Tatarstan. And also it was interesting because some of the language that Tatarstan used in the past was being picked up by, for example, Yakutia, mm-hmm. which again, because it has, four people but massive diamond mines, is also a sort of a donor region in that respect. So actually, I think there was a sense of we need to kind of slash this down now. So I think there is kind of the grand logic says this has to be done. But if we look at the specific risks, I still feel that it does leave open this issue of, the Tatar identity as something that can be mobilized in the future, even if at the moment there is no one there. Though things can move quickly. I mean, who on earth would ever have thought that Baltic folk music right. would become the basis for a revolution?
Right.
So, I think we have to have a certain degree of humility.
And no matter what Moscow does, this is not going away. I keep saying over and over and over again for a reason. This is Russia's largest ethnic group by far. By far.
Quite well, unless you believe Sputniki Pogrom, which says, actually, no, it's several ethnic groups.
Right.
But anyway, but the point is this is about
their policy, too. I mean, they are dividing into smaller groups. I mean, and for example, baptized Russians, baptized Tatars, they already start considered as a part of Russian supernation. There are some Mishars, other ethnic groups, they're part of other bigger groups. So this is also official policy.
But if they push it again, that's when you precisely get the risk of groups mobilizing it. Because this is not just simply about, passport and such like. I mean, basically, this is about the raw building blocks of politics, which is economic access, economic control, both for regions and for people within those regions.
Yeah.
So, I still feel that. And I think I want to throw in just one other interesting dimension. The extent to which, although there'd always been this fear that basically sort of Salafist extremism of the sort we see in the North Caucasus could spread into Tatarstan, but actually, on the whole, Tatarstan has been stable. Has been very stable. The kind of the combination of the religious and the political and indeed the security authorities together had very much been able to hold the line. And I don't just simply mean in a North Caucasus sense of people disappearing off the streets and turning up mysteriously dead with electric burns on them, but in the sense of actually presenting an alternative model and narrative. I wonder if that will be damaged.
Well, no, and yeah, I think that's right, Mark, and I'm not exactly objective here. I kind of got a soft spot for Tatarstan because I lived in Kazan in the early 90s and actually studied Russian at Kazan State University when you were a student, I believe, as well, Rim. But I've always looked at Tatarstan as kind of the grown-up of the Russian regions. Yes, there's corruption here. Yes, there's cronyism. You find me a place in Russia where there isn't. But in that context, I've always seen Tatarstan as a relatively well-governed, well-managed region. It was one of the adults. What happens now? I mean, it was one of the adults because it had something that it really cherished. And now it doesn't have that anymore. And I do wonder if this is going to change the internal political dynamics in the region. One other thing, before we shift into the second half and start talking about the regions in general in a broader sense, the elephant in the room here, Tatneft.
Well, exactly. I wanted to mention it now because this is sort of, if even they say, we say that Shaymiev had some big pluses getting the real autonomy for him and for his family. But at the same time, I can say that the Tatneft and the ownership of the Tatneft by Tatarstan, it lies in the basement of this stability too. I can simply show a case of neighboring Bashkortostan, for example, where Bashneft also used to be in the hands of Bashkiri government, but as it went to first to the system, and then Igor Sechin's Rosneft bought it. So now I think nobody knows what's going on in Bashkortostan. All the parts of the population are complaining because the current president, Hamitov, nobody is satisfied with him. So the region also used to be very stable, but now it's a much,
and you attribute
much bigger problem.
Just to Bashneft falling out of the hands
also,
of the region.
Also because it was a main donor to the Republican original budget. the same .neft in Tatarstan.
Right.
So if the money now, typically, like in Soviet times, goes mostly again in to Moscow, and then you get something, because, I mean, just depending on your behavior,
right,
you are getting some parts of this money. So it immediately is reflected in the state of the economy, right, in the region. So Tatneft, if it goes to Sechin,
then Sechin covets it.
So Tatarstan can expect the same situation like in Bashkortostan.
And you could see a deterioration of living standards. Yeah. Now, you add a deterioration of living standards to the loss of this symbolic autonomy. That's combustible, no, Mark?
That's... Exactly. I think it therefore creates this potentiality that is open to whoever it is who is able and willing to try and take advantage of it. Now, it could be some kind of, you know, Navalny's local ally as part of a national opposition mm-hmm. movement. Or it could well be precisely someone who sort of tries to create a Tatarstan opposition movement. Or, as I said, what I think is, and this is me being unashamedly elitist, it's precisely about other elements within the elite, particularly elements that are losing out. At a time when the cake is shrinking,
mm-hmm.
Both because of what's generally happening to the national budget and also the very specific parameters of what's going on in Tatarstan, you know, some people are going to hold on to what's theirs, and other people are going to start losing out,
mm-hmm.
you know, disproportionately much. Well, these are the people who precisely, they have least to lose, and they have most reason to precisely try and build up some kind of political authority to the point where, I mean, not because they suddenly see the light and they realize that this is an iniquitous system, but because they're waiting to be bought off.
Right.
You have to have some reason to be bought off. And it's precisely just as it was with the national... elites within the Soviet Union,
right.
Once they start this process, which they think they can control, they may or they may well not be able to control.
It was the National Communist Parties that got a lot of this. They're the Republican Communist Parties.
Precisely, because they suddenly had to suddenly think, well, how the hell can we win real elections?
Right.
And so they reinvented themselves as nationalists.
Ukraine is a clear example of this. All right, well, on that note, I guess we can shift gears and broaden the aperture. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at what the change in Tatarstan status means for Moscow's relations with the regions going forward. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURO. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Eliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And also with us in the studio is Rim Gofanov, director of RFERL's Tatar Bashkir service. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFERL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Регионы, они фактически изолированы.
Чем больше самостоятельности, тем больше ответственности.
О необходимости изменения территориального деления и федеративного устройства.
Повестка дня вынесена тема развития связей субъектов Российской Федерации.
The change in Tatarstan's status, of course, did not happen in a vacuum. It comes as the Kremlin is pushing a project to establish a, quote, civic Russian nation with ethnic Russians as its, quote, state-forming core. We'll get into more of that in a bit. And it comes amid a general crackdown on regionalism in Russia, which the Kremlin appears to believe can easily turn into separatism. Mark, what does this Russo-centrism and anti-regionalism portend going forward? We touched on this a little bit in the first half, but this is a much broader phenomenon. There is talk right now of a further amalgamation of Russia's regions. They are reduced from 89 to 83. Russia claims there's 85 because they're including Crimea and Sevastopol, but we don't include those. But there's a talk of further amalgamation. There's talk of changing having no more ethnically based regions, for example. There's talk of turning Tatarstan into something of the Kazanskaya Gubernaya and things like this. So there's a lot of talk of super regions, changing the federal structure. We got this Russo-centrism going on. What do you see going forward?
Well, this is exactly why I felt that the change in status for Tatarstan was just part of a kind of inexorable larger logic of what we see as part of sort of Putin's, whether it's kind of prep for 2018 in the presidential elections, or I think more likely building the foundations for the post-2018 mm-hmm. Political order that he's planning on creating. And in a way, I think we're talking about three interlinked processes, which one can sort of put as, in one case, it's re-verticalization. He clearly wants to make sure that your brand stays intact, because I think we're once again seeing the power vertical coming very much to the fore.
It ain't vertical enough now?
Well, no, actually. This is the interesting irony, because what we're seeing is, in some ways, power vertical had been a fairly broad-based pyramid. Yes, of course, there was no question but that power flowed upwards. But nonetheless, there were precisely there were multiple, often competing, different channels that it took. You know, so it actually meandered quite a lot of the way, if we think of it in riverine terms. I think now he's looking for something that's much more streamlined, frankly, much more, and I don't want to push the parallel too far, but military. And this actually also links with a second element, which is consolidation. Again, I think a former model of Putinism, which was precisely about having multiple competing bodies handling all kinds of different things, so that precisely he could just simply let them fight amongst themselves and reach down and be the decider when he chose to do so. Mm-hmm. I think that is giving way to a new model, which is about a much sort of more streamlined system, whereby there are a relative handful of super agencies and superstructures under people whom he thinks are personally loyal to
himself. So we're talking about hyper-ruchnoy upravlenie, really, hyper-manual control?
Well, in a way, because I don't think he wants to do manual control. I mean, this is the striking thing, actually, just how phenomenally lazy an autocrat Putin is in so many ways. I think it's more that precisely, rather than have to keep reaching down, when you have multiple agencies, often it becomes dysfunctional. And that does require Putin or Putin's, you know, vicar on earth, whoever that may be, to exactly sort of deal with it. I think the idea is, I mean, he wants to have this smoothly running, simple system that really exists just to provide him with palaces, dacha, and rhythmic gymnasts, that he can just let the system run because he is sure about the loyalty. But since he has so few people on whom he
has to clone Dmitry Kozak like 100 times and appoint him to be the vicar.
Now, there's a charming image. So anyway, well, the verticalization and the consolidation, I think, are the sort of two big processes. And the third one is precisely this hints of Russification. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I mean, I think we need to be careful about making it sound too, you know, we're not quite at Nicholas the First and so forth territory. But nonetheless, I mean, I was struck by when Putin was recently in Mariel, and he spoke out against this sort of terrible thing about Russians apparently being forced to learn the local language.
Yes, he was outraged.
In a region in which 52% of the population are ethnic Mari. So in other words, he's complaining about Russians being forced to learn the majority language, right, and saying how appalling that is. Well, you know, welcome to the experience of pretty much every non-Russian in the Russian Federation. And I think it's interesting because, I mean, we mentioned in the past that Putin has never spoken out against the Tatars. And actually, this is one of the few small shreds of redemption within Putin, actually. He has not been anywhere near as racist as so many Russian leaders, which is admittedly the sort of smallest, exactly, sort of a thing. But nonetheless, I think systemically, I think we are seeing the system become more Russian ethno-nationalist. And in part, I think that may be because of, again, trying to simplify the system. You need to have an imperial elite.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think it may reflect a degree to which he feels that his flank is now vulnerable. When we have Navalny and Strelkov sitting down amiably for a chat, the fact that actually a degree of ethno-nationalism is beginning to become co-opted by opposition maybe means also it gives more reason for him to make sure that flank is secure.
Well, this raises an interesting question, maybe a counterintuitive one, because Mark, you noted Navalny when we were talking in the first half about who could pick up the mantle of the Tatar cause in Tatarstan. You said maybe one of Navalny's local people. I mean, can Navalny do both of those things? Can he have the flank of ethno-Russian nationalism, albeit liberal ethno-Russian nationalism, at the same time take up the cause of anti... Can you imagine Navalny telling the Tatars to take all the autonomy they can swallow?
Well, no, can but you imagine that? Let's be honest, given that the example of that was Yeltsin, who then sent the tanks into Chechnya, it's unfortunate. No, but I mean, I think in some ways, I mean, surely that is the mark of a true democratic politician, to be able to sort of basically tell multiple audiences exactly what they want to hear. I mean, the thing is, look, Navalny is on the one hand something of a Russian ethno-nationalist. But on the other hand, he does, it seems, genuinely believe in a law-based state. I mean, I think the thing is that it's not that he would turn around and say the Tatars are the bestest people around or anything like that. He would just simply say, we're part of a Russian Federation. We want to create a new system in which actually the law is equal to everyone else. Now, of course, he will emphasize different aspects of his message to different sectors of his electorate. And if we do see a kind of a local branch of Navalny Incorporated in Kazan, clearly it will wrap itself in the Tatar flag and the Tatar cause. Mm-hmm. But what I think, anyway, the key message will be precisely, it's a question of, look, we are best protected within a law-based state. Mm-hmm. And I think actually that is a perfectly rational, justified model, rather than just simply relying on the tolerance of the autocrat in Moscow, mm-hmm. to actually rely on the protections of the law.
Well, it's interesting. I remember back at the debates in the 90s when I was living in St. Petersburg in much of the 90s, and I got to know people who were involved with the Petersburg autonomy movement. Now, Petersburg had a special status of its own. It was a federal city like Moscow. But they were saying that Tatarstan should be the model for everybody. Mm. All the subjects of the Federation should have what Tatarstan has. It wasn't saying, take this away from Tatarstan. It was saying, give it to us too, and to everybody else for that matter. Let's create a truly federal state. Let's create a Russian Federation.
Bizarrely, what Tatarstan has got is in so many ways reminiscent of what Gorbachev was offering the regions of the Soviet Union,
yes.
with the revised Union Treaty,
yes.
that was scuppered by the August coup. So, I mean, absolutely, this fits into this kind of long-running, basically, is this an empire or is this a federation?
This is what it really does.
And in a way,
to.
What Putin is doing is shifting back much more. I mean, look, it was never a federation. But anyway, I mean, anyway, if we're talking about a spectrum, he's shifting it much, much more clearly,
yeah.
towards the imperial thing. Whereas actually, there is a great deal of sense in saying this ought to be a federation. But also, a lot of the other Russian regions, putting aside the minor issue of the massive embezzlement and corruption of the leaders, but nonetheless, likewise, many other regions also have basically tried to follow the same sort of model as Tatarstan, with having their own, not just their own little kind of mini embassy in Moscow, but precisely building connections outside, mm-hmm. the country, looking for region to region contacts. In many ways, I mean, a lot of regions have, in effect, what in American terms is a state secretary of state.
Right.
So, I mean, I think actually that's something that has been bubbling along implicitly for a long time.
Well, yeah, no, and the Tatarstan model from the 90s was one direction Russia could have been going, as you pointed out here, with the re-verticalization, the consolidation and the Russification. It seems to be now shifting dramatically away from that model. I wanted to talk to you a bit about this Russification, because this is something I know that you've been concerned about, not just in the past week or so, but for as long as I've known you, as long as we've been working together. This is something you've been following a while. I mean, you've covered the efforts to keep the Tatar language alive. How do you see this now, what's happening with the Tatarstan status, combined with this general Russification, this creation of, how is it formed, a civic Russian nation with ethnic Russians as the state-forming core? What does that mean to you?
Russification never stopped, actually, even during the Yeltsin times. I mean, it was slowed, but it still was going on. And it has two faces. One is, as I call, objective one. This is globalization, where only major languages with established markets with mass media, mm-hmm. are winning. It's like English, Spanish, Chinese.
Right.
So even Czech language, for example, can suffer in this, because it's already sort of, lives between bigger languages like Polish and German and English. So it's objective one. Globalization makes some assimilation processes much quicker. Mm-hmm. The second thing, this is real politics by Russian government to Russify the population inside the country, and sometimes even beyond the borders, mm-hmm. like with the use of Russian language. For example, its nervosity about the Kazakhstan announcement by Kazakhstan that it will switch to Latin,
alphabet, right?
It caused such a big reaction in Moscow. Mm-hmm. And the same, we had our own story with Tatars.
I remember when the Tatars wanted to switch to the Latin.
It was immediately cut by federal government and parliament. So they adopted a special law banning Tatar alphabet, switch to Latin. So and the Russian government was engaged in Russification. It now seems that most likely, my opinion, that the Russian government, Putin, are facing global challenges like catastrophe, actually, with population, demography, mm-hmm. really. It has really bad shape in Russia. At the same time, big powers are appearing on the borders of Russia, like China, for example. Mm-hmm. And the future of Russians, or Sino-Russian relations, it's look very, very interesting, by the way, in 20 and 30 years. So at the same time, given these latest sanctions, it means Russia will face technological backwardness very soon.
Decades of stagnation, as Alexei Kudrin said in an interview with Reuters this week.
So they are trying to come up with some solution, as they see it as a possible one, winning solution. But one of the tools of that is Russification. Mm-hmm. They think that if they consolidate or unite the society, it will be as much homogeneous as possible. They can win, and they can use this historical moment and then jump into the future. So I think this lies behind the latest attempts to speed up this Russification process in Russia.
How much fear do you have of this? Do you see in Tatarstan and Bashkortostan and the regions you cover? Are people very alarmed by this right now?
The people, I mean, the with Tatar identity, they are alarmed. But as I said, we have a biggest problem now. The mindset is being already standardized. This chauvinistic, this big power mentality, like we are really superpower Dzerzhava, but only we have few enemies. They fight us all the time. So this is hostility towards West. It produces this mindset, and this mindset is pretty much spread among Tatars and with all minorities.
Now, you've been covering for a while the fight over school the language of instruction in schools in Tatarstan. What's the state of that right now?
Formally, it's still continuing, I think, and the statement by Putin in Ashkarala was actually mostly addressed towards Tatarstan, because only in Tatarstan and Bashkortostan they are compulsory. Otherwise, in other regions, it's like, if you want, you can learn, but...
So the Tatar language is still compulsory in all schools in Tatarstan.
It's again, it has, again, two angles, you know. It's compulsory, but at the same time, it produces actually nothing, because it's done so badly. The quality of the teaching is so bad that actually the children, the students, they don't speak much Tatar. But it, again, cultivates this even hatred towards Tatar, because it is compulsory, but no quality. And it still continues, but the actual result is not that good for Tatar language.
Anything, Mark, you're writing, I see. Well, you've got something to say, I can tell.
Oh, I mean, on that last point, first of all, I mean, actually, it's interestingly reminiscent of the teaching of Russian in Eastern Europe during Soviet-occupied times. You know, everyone had to do it. It wasn't done well. Everyone resented the hell out of it. And therefore, a lot of people don't actually speak it that well. Because
almost nobody.
If you're determined not to learn something, then you can manage. Now, I mean, more broadly, I wanted to go back to this point about this sort of civic Russian nation with Russians as the state-forming core.
Yeah, can you make sense of that? Well, I mean, I know what they're trying to say. They're trying to, like they always do, pretend they're copying something from the U.S., essentially. When it bears nothing, in reality, it bears no resemblance whatsoever.
But also, I mean, what is clear is that actually those two things are directly antithetical.
Yes.
A civic Russian nation, that's fine. Just simply that your nationality is Russian, even if your ethnicity is other, and everyone is equal under the law, etc.
Yeltsin's concept of Rossiyanin. As opposed to Russia.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, not that it was ever applied under Yeltsin either. But, you know, but on the other hand, as soon as you have, but the Russians are the state-forming core, two things there. One is, and it immediately privileges the Russians. It immediately says, you know, everyone's equal except the Russians are particularly special, but everyone is equal. But the second point is, I like this business of the state-forming core. Because if one thinks about it, well, how was this state formed? And therefore, actually, you know, if you think about it, it was conquest, it was empire, it was Stalin. Right. I mean, those are really the three. I mean, I suppose we throw in actually the Russian Civil War. Now, those are basically the big engines that actually built, all of which were nasty, bloody, and exploitative. Now, of course, I don't think they're going to be presenting it in those terms.
Right.
That's why they are glorifying books. Stalin, Ivan Grozny, all the conquerors.
And Nicholas
now.
The First.
Yes.
So. Yeah, but on the other hand, but again, it's not actually. I mean, anyway, they're not necessarily emphasizing the values of Ivan the Terrible in Kazan that he conquered or whatever. Though, I mean, for what it's worth, I mean, let's be perfectly honest, speaking of Britain, if one looks at the ghastly array of murderers and rogues that are now sort of honoured as the great antecedents of Britain, I think that's just the nature of history. But again, what I want to come down to is the extent to which, if this is more than just language and rhetoric, if this is actually something that is real and a policy that is going to be applied, not only will it mean continuing to cherry pick from history and whitewash out all the bits that you don't cherry pick, all the bloody bits, which is basically what's left of Russia once you take out the, you know, there's only so far you can talk about the fact that everyone fought together in the Great Patriotic War. Well, sure, otherwise the NKVD put a bullet in the back of your head. So, you know, we're going to talk about that, but more to the point, there will ultimately come some crucial moments where Moscow will have to choose. How far does it privilege the Russians in terms of resources and rights? And how far does it actually say, no, everyone is meant to be equal under the law? And I think we know the answer.
We know the answer to that question.
Exactly. But the point is, I think, you know, again, we are coming to a point where I think there are more and more crunch issues, whether it's in terms of culture, language, alphabets and all those kind of things, which obviously matter. Whether it's in terms of, you know, we're already seeing that the teaching of history has become, you know, essentially politicized. The teaching of history is entirely political these days. Mm-hmm. It has little to do with scholarship and everything to do with catechism. But more to the point, you know, what happens when we start to have people saying, well, actually, we need to curtail local customs. We need to start making, when we have to make tough decisions about what's going to be in the national curriculum, precisely we'll take Tata out of it. What's going to happen when we start seeing more and more regions complaining about the allocation of funding? I mean, these are all the really practical issues. And in a way, I think at the moment we have a state that is kind of, it's increasingly moving towards a Russian imperialist rationalization. Mm-hmm. But it's also deeply aware of the problems. And it's hoping with rhetoric to basically get around that, and with elite capture. Now, that goes up to a point. But particularly with elite capture, there comes a point where actually elites might find themselves either, they just simply become the local representatives of the metropolis. And this is how Tsarist Russia essentially co-opted local elites. But the point is, and it then had to back them up with Russian troops.
Right.
Because periodically, precisely because the local elites were acting on behalf of the metropolis and not the local interests, there would be Bund. There would be all kinds of other sort of risings. And therefore you had to deploy force. This is not, I think, a state that is comfortable with the idea of doing that. It's got force, But on the other hand, I mean, you know, I think that there is an awareness. They're using the language of imperialism. I'm not convinced that they, at the moment, are actually looking for that.
And troops in the future will be actually mostly filled by ethnic minorities, actually.
Yeah. I mean, this is something the General Staff is terribly worried about. Exactly, well, Caucasus troops.
I can't help but recall a couple of years back having Paul Goebel on this podcast. I believe you were on too as well, Mark, and Paul said that he sees the same centrifugal forces pulling apart at the Russian Federation that he saw pulling apart at the USSR in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, the way Gorbachev dealt with that was to give more autonomy, and we know the result. Putin seems determined to not follow anything remotely resembling Gorbachev's path, but one has to wonder if the result might not be the same, if this might spark the kind of backlash that they fear.
This latest developments actually makes me draw another parallel with Milosevic, with his speech in Kosovo field, you know, in 1987, I think, as he became head of Serbia and went to Kosovo and made this famous speech where he said,
Nobody will be here.
Yeah. And I mean, putting Serbian population, again, this core, you know, of the new Yugoslavian nation, and we all know how he ended up, actually, and where he ended up. So I also see this possible future.
The Yugoslav variants?
Yeah, actually, I don't think that the Russian Federation is going to break apart. I think that is, in a way, I think, part of the obvious logic of the current rhetoric. But I don't actually think that the Kremlin either genuinely intends to privilege the Russian minority to quite that extent, or is actually willing to fight the consequences. I think this is I think what we're actually seeing is in classic terms is a policy that's going to start. They're going to in due course start seeing the problems, and they will have to hurriedly sort of reinvent themselves. I mean, I again, it seems perverse to be actually saying anything that sounds to defend Putin. And I suppose it's not so much that. It's that actually, I mean, I think Putin is perfectly willing to see bespoke violence. I don't think that he is in a position able to, and I don't know whether he'd be willing to, but I just don't think he's able to sit on a throne of bayonets. I don't think this is actually a state that can deploy that kind of level of force. And, you know, yes, he's got the National Guard and so forth, but I don't think that this can be another Soviet Union.
No, I don't. And I also don't. I agree with you that I do not think the Russian Federation is going to break up for a very simple reason. I don't see what it could break up into. You know, when the Soviet Union broke up, we knew exactly the 15 constituent parts it was going to break up into. Although at the time, Tatarstan was trying to get the status of a union republic, if you remember correctly.
It all started with this, yeah.
Yeah. But what does it break up into? And again, going back to where we started, the irony is the only truly viable state I could see coming out of that scenario is Tatarstan.
I think what happened when the Tsarist Russia collapsed. I mean, when in the sort of, I mean, in a way, if one thinks of this absolute sort of anarchy of the collapse of Tsarist Russia and the early civil war, you had all these kind of bizarre ad hoc Far Eastern republics.
Yeah. I mean, I think Tatarstan was independent
I mean, what the answer is that if it did happen, as I don't think it will, but actually, what it will happen not because in the main regions rise up. Yes, there are some that might be in that position. If it happens, it'll happen because the center breaks.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
exactly.
People will just kind of knock together whatever structures they can find.
Exactly a century ago, in July of 1917, nobody can expect that in few months, Bolsheviks will come to power and Finland will become independent. Poland, other national
the Baltic states,
regions over there. So everything is possible, I think.
Well, this is the big question hanging over all of this is how truly strong is this regime? Can the center hold? And there's many different opinions about this. I'm not going to cry wolf again and say this regime's in trouble, although it does appear to be so right now to a degree. And this has to all be viewed, these regional politics, within the context of the political health of this regime, and which is a a debatable topic. I change my mind about it almost daily, as do both of you, I'm sure. Well, on that note, I guess we can wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Also with us in the studio has been Rim Gilfano, Director of RFRL's Tatar Bashkir Service. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.